John Carty closing out the final evening talking about modular Hamiltonians in 2D CFT.
Thank you. Okay, I wanted to thank you all for coming on the last talk of the penultimate day when everybody is absolutely exhausted, I'm sure. I know that I am anyway, so it's been a very interesting workshop. I have really enjoyed particularly going to the quantum information talks, and it proves that you're never too old to learn something new. Anyway, I'm going to be talking about some work which we had hoped to post on the archive sometime during this conference, but obviously there's been far too much going on, and I really envied those people who do manage to actually post to the archive during a conference, and I know that one or two people have. This will probably appear in August. It's going to be, at least part of the talk is going to be covered in a paper a year or two ago by Amori and Hachikawa, but I'm going to be talking about some new time-dependent examples. So this talk is going to be about the entanglement Hamiltonian in two-dimensional CFTs. I call it the entanglement Hamiltonian because I first learned those words as a condensed matter as it says. And only later did I learn that it's actually called the modular Hamiltonian. So I may occasionally use the word entanglement Hamiltonian. Okay, I'm going to be talking about it in 2D CFTs, and the advantage of talking about those is that all the results that I will mention are going to be general for any 2D CFT, not just large C or rational or whatever. Probably to go beyond any of the results that I'll discuss, you probably need to be more precise as to what kind of CFT you're actually talking about, but all these results will be completely general. So let me just remind you what the modular Hamiltonian is. We imagine that we have a Hilbert space and we have a bipartition of the Hilbert space into A and A bar. In the case of a field theory, we usually think about HA as describing the degrees of freedom in a particular spatial region, and A bar being its complement. And then we imagine that the whole system is described by a density matrix rho, and in most cases here it's going to be a pure state, but not always, not necessarily. And then we define the reduced density matrix of A to be the trace over H of A bar of rho. And then we write this as E to the minus 2 pi Ka, and this defines what we call the modular Hamiltonian of the region A. Okay? And there's lots of examples known, and those of you who, for example, went to Horacio Cassini's lectures will have actually seen this, where you can actually write the modular Hamiltonian as some weighted integral over a local operator, which is usually the time component of the energy momentum tensor, that is the Hamiltonian density. And an example where where you can actually do this, and I'll just talk about the 1 plus 1 dimensional case, is when you have an infinite system, A is an interval between minus R and plus R, B is the rest, and then you can write Ka is the integral over A of R squared minus X squared over 2R T00 of X dx. So that's a very well known example. So one of the questions that I'd like to ask is, when can we actually do this? Under what circumstances can we do it? And if we can, what does that tell us about the spectrum of Ka? How can we use this to compute the entanglement entropy? I'll just talk about this particular example and just mention a couple of other known ones, but then I want to spend the second half, hopefully, talking about some new examples where the state actually is a function of time. And then, if I have time, I will mention what goes wrong more generally in the cases that we can't do this. Okay. Any questions so far? I hope not. Okay, so let me just try to give you a simple derivation of this formula, and it won't be quite the one that Horatio gave, though in fact it will be completely equivalent. So we want to actually describe the reduced density matrix of this interval A, and as you saw in the lectures, if you have you can do this via the half integral in Euclidean space. So if imaginary time is going up the board, space is going across the board, this is tau equals zero, you can do the Euclidean path integral from minus infinity up to zero. This gives you the ground state wave functional along here. You can do the same from plus infinity down to zero. That gives you the conjugate. If you just sew these things together, you will just get the trace of the density matrix, which is one, suitably normalized. If you just want to take the trace over A bar, sorry, that's A bar, not B, then what you do is to sew these together along A bar. This is still A here. And the rows and the columns of the reduced density matrix row A are labeled basically by the values of the fields above this slit and below this slit. Now, there's a point here which perhaps has not been stressed enough, but when you actually use this to compute, for example, the entanglement entropy in a continuum field theory, it's actually divergent. That means there has to be some kind of UV regulator, and we're talking about a continuum theory here, not a lattice theory. So where does this UV regulation actually appear from? Well, it appears from the fact that there may be difficulties in making this sharp division, this sharp bipartition of the Hilbert space and the operator algebra acting on this in a continuum theory, because operators have to be smeared, and what happens if the smearing goes over both A and A bar. Now, there are lots of subtle questions there, and I don't want to get into them. All I just want to say is that you can actually avoid this by, in some small epsilon vicinity of the entangling point, that's the boundary between A and A bar, you actually make a projection. You have a projection operator P acting in some epsilon neighborhood of the boundary here. And you do the same here, and the same here, and the same here. And once you have done that on the projected state, there is no difficulty in thinking about how you would make the Schmidt decomposition of the state. This projection operator is supposed to be onto a complete set of eigenstates of some eigenstate of a complete set of commuting observables. So it implies having some kind of a boundary condition here. So that then when you, let me try and use a color just to be clear, so that when you actually do this, there is now some slit here, and that's going to be of size epsilon. So epsilon is going to be a macroscopically large size, but still much smaller than anything else in the problem. Now, it's not obvious whether the results that you get out of here, out of this particular regularization, are going to be the same as what you would get if you put the theory on a lattice, but one would expect that the universal quantities would be, and then there'd be irrelevant corrections to scaling, which would depend upon the particular way that you impose the cutoff. And with that in mind, we can actually change this from a slit to actually a small disk. So that's the easiest thing to actually think about. We're actually going to take out of the space-time a small disk here and a small disk here, okay, of radius epsilon. Okay, and that's going to be important. What is important is that now if I calculate the trace of rho, for example, by sewing the top edge of the slit to the bottom edge, what I have in the whole Euclidean space-time is now topologically an annulus, okay, because it has two boundaries now. Having said that, I need to also say what boundary conditions I'm actually going to put on these slits. And, of course, for a given conformal field theory, there's, in principle, some infinity of boundary conditions that I can put there. But there's a special set which are called the conformal boundary conditions. And the idea there is, once again, if this length epsilon is macroscopic, then under RG flows at the boundary, we will always flow to one of these conformal boundary conditions. So I'm going to assume a conformal boundary condition there also. Having done that, I can now conformally, or I can put a different set of coordinates on this annulus, which basically correspond to making a conformal mapping. So a particular conformal mapping which I can do is to basically draw the annulus in another way, draw it as basically a strip where I identify the top edge with the bottom edge, make it to have length 2 pi, and then it's going to have some particular width W, which I'm going to work out in a moment. And the conformal mapping which does this, if this is the Z plane and this is the W plane, is just W is log of just get the minus signs right, excuse me. log of C plus R over R minus C. And that immediately tells us by seeing, so basically this boundary gets mapped into the left edge, this boundary at the right edge. So I should draw these as a green boundaries here. And then if you work out this width, it's basically something like 2 log R over epsilon, or maybe 2 R. OK. So that's very easy. And now what we want to do is to work out the logarithm of the reduced density matrix. So as I told you, this is an operator which whose rows and columns are labeled by the values of the fields above and below the slit. That's so before I join the annulus up, the bottom edge of the slit is here and the top edge is here. So I want to know what operator takes me from here to here, and that's just the generator of translations going up the annulus, or it's just the Hamiltonian. So if basically I call these coordinates u and v, then I can write Ka is just the Hamiltonian, the translation of the translator in the v direction of TVV over the image of A here, which is this thing, du. Okay? So I can just now take this expression back into the z-plane. It's just equal to the integral over A of TYY of X DX, which is now integrated along here. And then I just have to see how the energy momentum tensor transforms and the Jacobian. When I do this, I get a factor of du by the x squared from here, and I get a factor of du by the x here. So finally, this is just the integral of t 0, 0 divided by f prime of x dx integrated along A. Okay? Plus maybe a constant coming from the Schwarzian, which you actually get when you transform the stress tensor, but this constant isn't really important as long as you make sure that the trace of rho is 1. So there are other ways that you can actually do that. Okay, so if we use this function here, plug in 1 over f prime of x, this is what you will get. Okay, so this is just a slightly different derivation of what is usually done in Minkowski space and talking about Rindler cones and that kind of thing. But for what I'm going to do later, the pictures are much easier in Euclidean space, so I'm going to stay. I've spent most of my life doing Euclidean conformal field theory, and I'm just going to stay there. I'm sorry. Okay, so it's quite interesting, though, if you look at what are the flow lines here. Okay, so the flow lines are just the real and imaginary parts of this function. They basically go go vertically here, horizontally here. If you look at them here, then they look something like this, and something like this. And anybody who's done elementary electrostatics or magnetostatics knows what that is. These are just the red lines are just the flow lines of a bar magnet, okay, with a north pole here and a south pole here. So these are just the lines of force between a plus charge here and a minus charge here. And of course, this function here is just the function that you would use to solve this electrostatics problem. And the real and imaginary parts of this being constant are just the equipotentials and the field lines, okay? And that's going to be true in general for all the problems that I've been talking about. So if you're getting a little bit tired at this point, everything I'm going to say tonight is just going to be 2D electrostatics, and that's all. Okay, so, right, so if we're interested in the spectrum of Ka, okay, how do we think about that? Well, a better way to actually think about that is to conformally transform this strip or annulus. Again, it's just going to be the spectrum of the Hamiltonian acting up the disk, and if we make now an exponential transformation of this, so that the minus infinity goes to the origin, plus infinity goes to infinity, the right green line goes to the positive real axis and the negative one to the negative one, and the left-hand one to the negative one, then basically now this picture just looks like this, of course. And you see that the Hamiltonian now is just the generator of scale transformations. So it's just what we call L0 in boundary conformal field theory. So in fact, Ka is pi over W times L0 plus a constant involving C. So the eigenvalues of the modular Hamiltonian in one of these CFT cases, in fact, all the examples that I'll talk about now, are always just going to be pi over W, whatever W is, it happens to be this here, times the eigenvalues of L0. However, the allowed eigenvalues of L0 depend upon the boundary conditions, we can call them A and B, that we choose here. It's the allowed spectrum of a boundary conformal field theory, given that you have a boundary condition here, A here, and B here. But for all the minimal models, and it, to a certain extent for rational CFTs, we know what these are. But it's just the spectrum of L0 that tells us everything that we need to know. It tells us about the asymptotic form of the density of states, goes like e to the square root of c times e. And so basically everything is there. Okay, so that's the spectrum. What about how do we compute the entanglement entropy from this? And once again, that's only going to depend upon a few universal quantities. It's easier to actually to think about computing the Renyi entropies. So the Renyi entropies, S-A-N, are 1 over 1 minus n times the logarithm of the trace of rho A to the n, and this is just e to the minus 2 pi n times ka. So that basically means that instead of going around once, we just go around n times. So our torus, our annulus rather, is going to be 2 pi n instead of just 2 pi, but it's still an annulus. Okay, and the width is going to be the same. So what we'd like to do is to compute basically the partition function on this annulus. Now, if you look at W, it's log R over epsilon, and I told you that R was much bigger than epsilon, so I haven't really drawn this right. What it really looks like is that there's an annulus that looks like this, and it's very, very long. So it's 2 pi n going around here, and it's W going here. And what we really have is a cylinder, is a long cylinder with two ends, right? So so basically, we can compute, the best way to compute the partition function isn't by going around this way, but by going along this way, because that's going to be just dominated by whatever the ground state is of the Hamiltonian acting this way. So basically, S A of n, well, not quite this trace of rho A to the n, is basically going to be, we're going to have a boundary state here and a boundary state here, A, 0, 0, B, because now we're not taking a trace, we're actually looking at the projection onto these boundary states. And then whatever is the E to the minus the ground state energy times W. So this thing is well known to be, try and get the factors right, pi C times this width, W, divided by 6, divided by 2, and also divided by the circumference, which is 2 pi n. Okay, so that gives us trace of rho A to the n. What we really need to do just to make sure that we have normalized this properly is to normalize it by trace of rho A to the n, because we haven't really made sure that our density matrix was normalized. When you do that, then you get the same expression here, but without the 1 over n, but raised to the power n. So that gives you this famous factor of n minus 1 over n. All this is really old stuff. It's in the paper of Halsey, Larson, and Helchek. But I just want to say that it's not just going to apply to this particular example, but it's going to apply to all the examples where we can do this mapping to the annulus. Okay, it's just that the form of W is going to be different. Anyway, when we do that, we then find that Sn of A, let me just write it up here. Sn of A goes like C over 12, 1 plus 1 over n, W. But then you get this extra term that comes from taking the log of these quantities, and these are called the Affleck Ludwig boundary entropies. So GA is minus log of this overlap, and the same for B. So that when you compute the Renyi entropies, and I can set n equals 1 here and get the famous result for the entanglement entropy, you see that you get these additional terms here, which depend upon the boundary conditions that you choose to put on these disks around the entangling surface. And you also notice that in the entanglement entropy itself, if you set n equals 1, you could always absorb these into the UV cutoff epsilon, the regulator. But you can't do that for every n. So in principle, these universal quantities can actually be extracted by looking at the different Rényi entropies. Okay, so that's how. So I've worked out those examples, and I'll just draw some pictures now of other examples where you can actually do this. So one example which is pretty well known is that when you take a semi-infinite interval, and you call this A, and you call this A bar, so A is at the end of a semi-infinite interval, and now you have a boundary here, and so that when you look at this in space-time, in Euclidean space-time, you actually have a real boundary here, and you also have a boundary around this entangling point. So you get a very similar result, apart from a factor of 2, except that the one of these boundary entropies comes from the real boundary, and the other one comes from the entangling surface. Okay. You can also do the example of one interesting example is if you have a totally finite system, and this is a bar. And now, once again, in space-time, we have a boundary here and a boundary here, and one around the entangling surface. And you might not think that's an annulus, but of course, as long as these two boundaries are the same, or the boundary conditions are the same, they really just basically join up at infinity, and it's still an annulus. And you can play all kinds of games. You can do it at finite temperature. You can do it in other cases. But there are lots of cases, and I'll mention one at the end, hopefully, where you, in fact, in most cases, you can't do it. And I'll hopefully have time to mention an example of what goes wrong there. But in all the cases that you can, once you have taken out this disk around the entangling point, that the space-time region is topologically an annulus, then you can always do this. And I think the message is that the spectrum of Ka is always that of a boundary conformal field theory, and that you always get a similar formula for the entanglement entropy with just a different form here for W, depending on the particular geometry that you're looking at. Any questions so far before I go on to the time-dependent cases? Yeah? What's the next contribution here? Okay, so what you can get are interesting terms that go like something like, in terms of W, they're down exponentially in W, but W goes like the log. So they basically, if L is the length of your interval, they basically go like L to the minus delta over N, where delta is some scaling dimension of the bulk conformal field theory. So it gives you corrections to scaling. But the corrections, the powers of the corrections depend upon n, which is sort of interesting. Usually when you have corrections to scaling, they're kind of universal and they're the same powers for whatever quantity you look at. But in this particular case, the corrections to scaling depend upon which particular n entropy you look at. Okay. Right, so now I'm going to look at some time-dependent examples corresponding to quantum quenches. And we've looked at two examples. Actually, we have looked at three. We've looked at what we call a global quantum quench. I'll explain what a quantum quench is in a moment. A local quantum quench and what we call an inhomogeneous one, which... but I'm just going to focus on a global quantum quench. So the idea of a quantum quench is that you prepare a system in a particular pure quantum state. It's, you would like it to be something like the ground state of some initial Hamiltonian, and then at time t equals zero, you instantaneously change your Hamiltonian to a new one h, and you evolve with that new Hamiltonian. So what you want to do is to actually take an initial state, call it psi zero, evolve with your new Hamiltonian, and then ask questions about what happens, like what, how do the correlation functions depend upon t? Do they become stationary, et cetera, et cetera? Now, in general, that's so we are going to work, we're going to look at the case where H is the Hamiltonian of a 1 plus 1 dimensional CFT. That already simplifies things, but we're going to simplify things further by taking a particular initial state, which you've probably seen before. I think Tom mentioned it. It's e to the minus beta over 4h CFT times a conformal, acting on a conformal boundary state. So a conformal boundary state is somewhat like a product state, right? It's like a totally unentangled state. And by evolving in imaginary time for a small amount of imaginary time, you actually introduce a finite amount of entanglement into this state, and moreover, in the CFT, you make it into a normalizable state because the conformal boundary states by themselves are not normalizable. So, and this beta is just chosen so that the mean energy in this state is what you would get if you looked at the same theory at an inverse temperature beta. Okay, so then we want to evolve this with for a particular time t, and so our density matrix at time t is basically going to be something like this, e to the plus iht. And so we would like to understand the entanglement in this and in particular work out the entanglement Hamiltonian. Okay, so once again, because I grew up doing Euclidean quantum field theory, what we're actually going to do is to work out e to the minus tau h, e to the plus tau, e to the plus tau h, and we're going to do the calculation, and at the end, continue tau goes to it. You could probably do all of this in real time, but at least you could mirror our calculations. But once again, the pictures are just much more understandable in Euclidean space, because once again, it's just going to be two-dimensional electrostatics. Okay, so how do we do this using the path integral? Well, we're not in the vacuum anymore. So we don't start from minus infinity, but we start from somewhere here. So now this is tau equals zero. This length here is beta over 2. We have a boundary state B here, a boundary state B here. And what we want to do is to evolve for a time beta over 4 plus tau, and then beta over 4 minus tau. So our state is going to be here somewhere. Okay, and then we are going to split the Hilbert space again, and the calculation that we can do is when this is A and this is A bar. So this is an infinite system, and A is semi-infinite, and B is, and A bar is. So we're just going to take this point to be the origin. So what we want to do, here's our reduced density matrix, therefore, is the path integral on this slit strip, okay, with the rows and columns of row A labeled by the values of the fields once again above and below the slit. And we want to do this for real tau to begin with, and then continue our answers. So once again, this is going to be, once again, we're going to remove, I think that was green, but I'm probably not being consistent, but never mind. Maybe it's yellow now. We're going to remove a small disk, okay, here. And once again, once we have done that, if we sew this to this, this is, once again, topologically an annulus. And the electrostatics problem is that we put a charge here between two conducting plates. So that's a problem that you can give your students. Okay. And you can solve it by the method of images, or you can just stare at the answer. Okay. So the field lines now go like this, and like this, and like this, to the middle. But an interesting thing that you will notice that didn't happen before is that A no longer lies along a field line, and that's going to have a consequence. Okay? So we want to do the conformal mapping of this to the annulus. And I think this is the one occasion where I need my notes, so just to write it down. So the conformal mapping of this to the same annulus that I talked about before with the red lines, whoops. Oh, well, I've got red lines and green lines. Red lines are now going across here. Okay. Those are the lines of force. This boundary is this, and this boundary is these two. The conformal mapping is just, so this is the z-plane, is just the logarithm of the sinh of pi z minus l tau I tau over beta divided by cosh z plus I tau over beta. And if you expand out the sinh and the cosh in terms of their poles and zeros, that's exactly what you would have gotten by the method of images. Okay, so what we want to do is to plug this into our formula. Now, the interesting thing that happens is because A is not running along a red line, in fact, it's doing something like this. So this is A, this is the image of A, And what we were instructed to actually do was to write Ka as the integral of T00dV along a line here, but we want to actually distort it to actually run along the image of A, which we can do because of the conformal boundary condition here. So this is an integral along A of T of W dW plus T bar of W bar dW bar, using the fact that 0, 0 is the sum of the holomorphic plus the anti-holomorphic parts of the stress tensor. And so when we map this back to the strip here, this becomes, sorry, that's along the image of A, we get something which is like integral tz dz over f prime of z along A plus integral t bar dz bar times f prime of z bar. And the main point is that because of this, f prime is no longer real along A. So these two things are not equal. So in this time-dependent case, and this is true of all the time-dependent cases that we looked at, you don't just get in, when you write the entanglement Hamiltonian here, you don't just get some integral over t plus t bar, which is the Hamiltonian density, you get something involving t minus t bar, which is the momentum density also. Right. And then you do this and with this particular function here, and then you analytically continue tau goes to it. And I'll just tell you what the answer is because it looks very, very simple. So basically, at the end, what we find is that this thing is beta over pi, but it's important that it's beta, times an integral from 0 up to 2t of t right of x and t dx, which we can write also. So this is involving the right moving part of the stress tensor at time t. But because this is just a function, in fact, of x minus t, because it's right moving, we can write this as also beta over pi minus t to plus t, t right moving of x of t of 0 dx. Now, these equations have a very simple interpretation, okay? If we were in a thermal state, then the entanglement Hamiltonian would just be the integral from minus infinity to plus infinity of t 0, 0. Okay, well, it's not quite that. First of all, it's just tr, and it's not integrated from minus infinity to plus infinity. But there's a very simple interpretation of this within what's called the quasi-particle picture. So now I'm going to draw a space-time picture in real time. So now this is x, and this is time. This is at particular time t. Here is a. Here is a bar. This is 2t. This is t. This is minus t. And it's just saying from here that if I want to write it in terms of the t at the particular time t, then it's due to the right movers, which are falling on this interval A. That is, the entanglement between A and A bar is to these, which is, of course, precisely the same as the right movers that start at time t equals 0 from between minus t and plus t. And as far as that part of the entanglement goes, then basically it looks thermal. So there's a region here which is part of A, which in fact thermalizes. Now, you may worry that this doesn't seem very symmetric between A and B, because I could make a similar argument for KA bar, and that would involve only left movers. But actually, the point is that because of the conformal boundary condition here, which is only a distance beta over 4 away in admittedly imaginary time, there's a conformal boundary condition here that says t equals t bar. So actually, when they're emitted, the left movers and the right movers are entangled and correlated over a distance of order beta. So within some distance of order beta, the picture that you get from the right movers is the same as the picture that you get from the left movers. Okay, so I think I have 5 minutes or so left. Well, I guess I started a bit late, but I'm sure everyone's anxious to get to their dinner, so I'll just wrap up. The other time-dependent examples work in the same way. There is something called a local quench, where once again you can map it to an annulus, so use the same technology. So I'd like to briefly mention, only briefly because I don't understand it completely, what goes wrong in more general cases. And the prototype of what goes wrong, and it's something that me and my colleagues have been hammering our heads against for years, is trying to compute in a 1 plus 1 dimensional CFT the entanglement entropy or anything when A consists of more than one interval. So now we're looking at the case once again in the infinite line. We're looking in the vacuum, no time dependence. And we have A is the union of two disjoint intervals, which I'll call A1 and A2. So once again, we can actually do the same trick. We can take out discs around the entangling point. And so you can see immediately that the topology of this space-time is no longer an annulus. It's a sphere with four holes. It's heterogeneous. So there's no way that we can conformally map this to an annulus. But it's interesting to figure out what goes wrong if you try to actually do this. Okay, so I'm just going to... You can show, without loss of generality, that you can make these two intervals symmetric about the origins. So this is A, this is B, this is minus A, and this is minus B. And there's a special circle here, which is, I'll try to draw, which has radius square root of AB. Okay? And now what we want to do is to just draw the, you know, we can all do, this is a perfectly well-posed problem in electrostatics. What are the flow lines? What are the equipotentials? And so basically the field lines, of course, start off like this, and then they go a bit like this. They get distorted by the presence of the other charges. And then something strange happens, that that basically you would try to think about this evolution as being due to some kind of modular Hamiltonian, which might be ... the integral of T00 over f prime of x dx, where what is the best guess for this function? Well, it's just something like log of z minus a over z minus b, z plus b over z plus a. That is certainly the complex potential due to these four charges. Okay, but so if you evolve with this guess for the entanglement Hamiltonian, this line will evolve to here, will evolve to here, but eventually what happens is that you reach a point here which looks a bit like this, and you reach a point here which looks a bit like this, and the evolution just stops. And the reason that it stops is that this conformal transformation fails to be conformal at these points here and here. And it must be so, because if you work out f prime of z, then it has four poles, so it has to have two zeros somewhere. And these are where the zeros are. So if you try to use this guess for the entanglement Hamiltonian, then the problem is that you can't propagate it. That is, you can only propagate it for a certain time before it stops. And the time at which it stops depends on the cross ratio of these four points. If the two intervals are a long way away, you can do it for almost a time to pi, but not quite. And once you actually stop there, you can still actually continue if you want. That is, you can propagate this way and this way and this way and this way and the same out here. But this is with a different Hamiltonian. Call it KB. And what you have to do to go from the KA propagation to the KB propagation is something really non-local, because you have to make a Schmidt decomposition of the state that you have here and match it onto a Schmidt decomposition of this state. So it looks very, very difficult. So you can sort of write a formula that this is like e to the minus theta 0 ka times whatever operator, which is a mapping from the Hilbert space A to the Hilbert space B, e to the minus 2 pi theta 0 kb times x dagger. But that's not really very useful, because you don't know how to take the logarithm of that thing. Right, so you might think that that you're kind of stuck there. But amazingly, there's a paper of Cassini and Huerta where for a free fermion, for a chiral fermion, but it doesn't matter, you can just add up the two chiral relatives, they do manage to actually work out Ka. But what happens is, as far as I understand it, is that when you evolve the operators, like, so you actually have fermion operators here, and you can think about how they evolve under Ka, they basically become bilocal. That is, what happens is that a fermion at a point here mixes with a fermion at a point here somewhere, such that they map to the same point on this quasi-annulus. Okay? So with this mixing, you can actually do it, and everything seems, in a way that I don't quite understand now, to go smoothly through this singularity. And it's actually been proved that their modular Hamiltonian satisfies the KMS condition, so it's a very good modular Hamiltonian. So whether you can do this for a general CFT and not a free one, I'm not sure, but what this is some kind of orbit folding of the CFT, and it will be interesting to understand that a lot more. And I think there are most other examples have the same problem. If you want to consider a single interval at finite temperature on an infinite system, then you've got this thing happening on the torus. So once again, you can't conformally map this torus with two holes to an annulus, obviously. And that's because this F prime has additional zeros where the propagation stops. But maybe you can still do something. So at this point, it becomes a bit of an exercise in complex analysis, but that's always an interesting thing to do, isn't it? So I think I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Questions?
As far as this last point, you might expect that the actual entanglement entropy has a nice function of the cross ratio, even though this way of computing it has a problem.
Yeah.
Is there some analog of a bootstrap equation for these X matrices?
Well, I don't know about these X matrices, but as you probably know, you can compute the Renyi entropies in terms of a four-point function of what are called twist operators.
Yes.
And there is then there is something known about the bootstrap for that. It's a matter of computing the conformal blocks, but in a sense, you know something about the conformal blocks, particularly at large C. So there is some work on what happens at large C, yes, certainly. And you're absolutely right. Certainly, the entanglement entropy itself is just going to be some nice, smooth function of the cross ratio, kind of boring, actually. So what I didn't mention at the beginning is, why do you want to understand KA? Well, as we heard in the earlier talks, it allows you to calculate relative entropies in a nice way. So that's why you would like to have a nice form for KA. Also, when you get nice formulae like this, then it gives you a nice physical picture about where the entanglement entropy is coming from. So, this mixing is a beautiful idea, but then I don't know what it's telling us. This is just a single interval where you don't need to compute. I mean, the point is that if for example, you do the same construction at finite temperature, for example, or in a finite system, but not a torus, then you can still do the same conformal mapping. You just get a different answer for this W, Now the W is just a log of the sinh of whatever it is. So it's all the usual formulas which have been worked out, but I don't know if that quite answered your question.
Okay, let's thank John again.